this encore presentation of Rob is a Podcast with my interview with Yul Kwon from 2020 is sponsored by our friends over at Hyundai. Find out more about the all-new Hyundai Tucson, where they question everything. Learn more at Hyundai.com. Hey, everybody, what's going on? Rob Cesternino back here with you to set you up for today's special presentation of Rob Has a Podcast. As many of you know, I am still in the midst of my cross-country move. Good news, we have landed. We are here in North Carolina, but we're still getting set up. So I have a special presentation for you here today. In 2020, right after Winners at War, I had the great pleasure of speaking with Yul Kwon. It was another one of my favorite interviews that I ever did on the show, and I thought it was a great time to share that, considering that we had just got done talking about the 19th best season of Survivor. That was Survivor Cook Islands, and I have to give a big thank you to Taryn Armstrong, who filled in for me this week on the 19th best season of Survivor with Mari Forth and Matt Scott. I am still working my way through their record-breaking podcast from Wednesday night. I highly suggest you check it out, the 19th best season of Survivor. And of course, they talked a great deal about the brilliance of Yul Kwon, and I had a great chat with him after Winners at War. We did talk a lot about Winners at War, but also about a lot of other things, including a little bit of Survivor Cook Islands, but a lot more about Yul and his feelings about being a Survivor player and his run on the show. And I just think it's an all-around great showcase of Yul Kwon, as we're talking about him this week as the winner of the 19th best season of Survivor, Survivor Cook Island. So I hope you enjoy this encore presentation of Rob is a Podcast. Before I throw it to the 2020 interview with Yul Kwon, I want to take a moment and thank our friends over at Hyundai. And of course, that here, I'm going to mention something a little bit about our road shows. And over the last 6 years, I've taken Rob is a Podcast on the road to a lot of great venues around our country, from theaters to playhouses and comedy clubs. We've taken our shows out to the communities where the fans are to be able to have in-person live shows. But since the pandemic, we've had to cancel a number of our live shows and tour dates. And we're hoping that with the support of Save Our Stages, the venues that we've come to love will be able to make it through this time so that we can all get together in person soon. And Hyundai is working to support Save Our Stages and help keep so many of these venues that we've been to around the country open. To give you an update on what I'm thinking about live events going into 2021 and beyond, as of right now, Survivor 41 is scheduled for the fall. I do not have any live shows planned for Survivor 41, and I know some people are asking for those to come out for the fall and the start of the new Survivor season, but after what we went through in 2020, where we had to cancel our live shows in New York, we had a very big live show that was going to be in Atlanta at the Ron Clark Academy. We had to cancel both of those and refund the tickets back to everybody. I would hate to ever have to go through that type of experience again, because that it was just so much craziness for everybody that was involved. So what I want to do is try to be as safe as possible and wait until the spring of 2022, which would be during season 42 of Survivor, so that we can get back out there. And that is what I'm thinking in terms of the next live show for Rob is a Podcast. And I know that with the help of Hyundai and their Save Our Stages initiative, that all of the venues that we know and love are still going to be back up and thriving in 2021 and beyond. So thanks again to Hyundai for their efforts to save our stages. And that's it for me here today live with you. I'm going to be throwing it to the 2020 version of myself. And I will, of course, be back with you on Wednesday night to talk about the 18th best season of Survivor, Survivor Palau. Very much looking forward to jumping back into things. But here is our encore presentation of my interview with Yul Kwon. All right, everybody, I'm very excited about this podcast today because I have long been looking forward to getting to talk to this person who is the winner from Survivor Cook Islands, the great two-time survivor. Please welcome Yul Kwon. Yul, how are you?
I'm doing great, Rob. Thanks so much for inviting me on your show. It's awesome to be here.
Yes, I'm really glad that we were able to work this out. You know, I had reached out. I said, let me take a shot in the dark. Maybe there was a chance that Yul would want to come on and talk. And luckily, we were able to work this out. I know you're incredibly busy. So on behalf of myself and the listeners, thank you for making some time to talk.
Yeah, I'm really happy to do this. And, you know, I'm very grateful for being invited onto your show. You know, for me, I felt kind of a little bit remiss because I know I sort of kind of dropped off the face of the planet like halfway through the season. Mm-hmm. I think I was more active on social media, on Reddit, things like that. And, and just kind of things went crazy for me at work. And so basically I just kind of went into a cave and have not had a day off in the last 3 months. So yes. I finally emerged. It's 4th of July weekend. I'm like, hey, I got your emails. I'm like, I'd love to go back on the show or onto your show just to kind of like thank all the people who were watching the season, you know, the people who are like fans, and especially the people who donated to the ALS campaign to support Stacey Tuttle and John Penner. I just felt like I never had the opportunity to just come back and thank everyone for that. So I'm more than happy to be here and have this opportunity to just engage with all your fans.
Well, you came out of nowhere, and really, I think that people were just dazzled by your every move on social media this season, especially coming out of the gate so hot that all of your posts and Instagrams and the blog that you wrote at the start of the season. So was that all part of your plan to really just take social media by storm?
You know, it was kind of, I mean, I guess part of it was I was gone from the Survivor community for so long. Mm-hmm. And, you know, there were a couple of things about the season that I wanted to do a little bit differently. I just thought I'd just kind of be more open with my thoughts and, mm-hmm. you know, just kind of expressing myself. You know, social media, I've always had sort of this conflicted relationship with, right? Because on one hand, it is a great platform for engaging with people. But, you know, you also just get a lot of stuff on social media that can be hard to read. Mm-hmm. And I'd say coming out of Cook Islands, I mean, I felt pretty lucky. I felt like I got a relatively good edit, all that kind of stuff. But I would say every winner and pretty much everyone who's ever been on Survivor has pretty deep emotional scars from some of the stuff that people say about them. Mm-hmm. So, you know, when I came off Cook Islands, I kind of decided just for my own mental sanity and, you know, I didn't want this to be something that I was like constantly thinking about. I just kind of took a clean break. But this time around, I just decided, you know, I think I wanted to be more open with myself. I wanted to just kind of express my thoughts and engage with all the people who I knew were kind of pulling for me to come back on the show. The other thing too was, you know, the reason I went back was because I wanted to try to do something to help Stacey Tuttle and Jonathan Penner. And I just realized like, I'm not going to be able to do much for them if like, you know, I'm not actually engaging with people and talking about what they're going through. So for me, it was kind of two things. Like on one hand, I just wanted to be more expressive, engage with people. And secondly, I wanted to try to get the word out.
Yul, could you talk a little bit about your relationship with the Penners? Because that, you know, I knew you and Jonathan were friends, but I didn't know to what degree that you were a part of the life of the Penners and vice versa.
Yeah. So as you know, Jonathan and I had a very complicated relationship on Survivor Cook Islands. You know, he backstabbed me and then we started off as friends and then he kind of backstabbed me and then we became friends again. It just kind of went up and down a bunch of times. But I always had a very strong respect for him. You know, even when you're playing the game, there are always moments where you're just talking about yourself and your family. And it's just very clear to me, he cared so much about his family. Like he was a very devoted family person. And after the show, you know, we stayed in touch and it, you know, it's not like we were best buddies like from day one, mm-hmm. you know, but we've known each other for a long period of time and over time got to know Stacey and his kids and, you know, became close to them. And, you know, when Stacey was diagnosed with ALS, and again, it wasn't something I had immediately known about, but once I heard and started kind of, you know, getting a better understanding of exactly what they were going through, it just really, it was just crushing. Like, you know, it's hard to see someone go through something like that, especially someone that you know well. So yeah. And I guess over time, our own relationship had just really deepened. I'd really come to see Jonathan just as a really tremendously kind human being. Like, he's incredibly honest. He's very giving to his friends, to his family. And I really started looking to him as a role model in many ways for the kind of father I wanted to become. So when I first met him, I didn't have kids. I wasn't even married. But as I got to know his kids, I was always struck by how thoughtful they were, how outspoken they were. And I remember thinking to myself one day when I was hanging out with him, like, you know, when I have kids, I want my kids to be like them. And I just tried to observe what it is that Jonathan did, and how he treated his own family, how he treated his own kids. And I remember just thinking to myself, like, that's how I want to be when I have kids myself. So he's always been, in many ways, a close friend and a role model for myself. Mm-hmm. And to see someone go through what he and Stacy and their children have gone through is just absolutely heartbreaking. So, yeah, I mean, you know, when I got the call to go back on Survivor, I was pretty ambivalent about it. I was probably leaning towards not going for lots of different reasons. But just trying to figure out how I could try to help Jonathan and Stacy, just feeling very sort of helpless, like I don't know what I could do besides just trying to be there as a friend. And that's when I got the call, and somewhere it clicked in my head, like, you know what, if I could actually use this opportunity to try to raise awareness and try to help them, I felt like it was something that I had to try. And I thought back to my first time on Survivor when I went on Cook Island. Mm-hmm. I don't think this got a lot of airtime. I talked about it a lot, but one of the reasons I went on the show, well, there are two main reasons I went on the show the first time. One was the lack of diversity I felt on mainstream television for people of color. Growing up, I didn't feel like there were a lot of people I could identify with or emulate, especially in the media. And so when I got this opportunity to go on the show, I thought, hey, this is an opportunity that doesn't come to many people in my community. And the great thing about a reality show is that it's not scripted, right? So even though, like, I might be cast for a specific reason because of this racial theme, I didn't have to read off the script that someone else wrote for me in terms of what that person thought I should be like, what I should say. So that was a big reason. By the way, my computer just went to sleep. Am I still on?
You're good. You're still sleeping. Okay. Yes.
I can't see you. Let me talk back on.
Yeah.
All right. Here we go. All right. The other thing was I had this very like personal and formulative experience in college. My best friend from childhood and I got into college together, mm-hmm. and we became roommates in my sophomore year. And he was diagnosed with leukemia. And so at the time, he was determined to have a terminal case, and his only chance of surviving was to have a bone marrow transplant. And, you know, I didn't know this at the time, but if you're Caucasian in this country and you need a bone marrow stem cell transplant, your chances of finding a match are quite good. There's a national registry, and enough people have volunteered to become registered that your odds are pretty decent of finding a good match. If you're a person of color, your odds are abysmal, right? So if you're Black, if you're Latino, if you're Asian American, your chances are much, much worse. So back then, there were so few Asian Americans who had registered that his chances of finding a match were about 1 in 15,000. Mm-hmm. So we ran search, we couldn't find a match. And so I spent a bunch of time trying to organize these bone marrow drives, trying to find a match for my friend, and ultimately did not succeed. And so my friend passed away in our senior year in college. And ever since then, I've been pretty active in trying to raise awareness about bone marrow, organizing bone marrow drives. But it's just hard, right? It's hard to get people to listen. It's hard to kind of break through the noise. And so when I got on Survivor, I felt like, look, if I go far enough on the show and, you know, if I were to win, I really want to try to use that, my 15 minutes to do something positive. And so after I won, I spent, you know, most of the next 2 years going around the country organizing bone marrow drives. And, you know, having been on Survivor gave me a platform that I wouldn't have had. I had all these organizations reach out to me, asking me to speak and things like that. And the one requirement I made was that I'm happy to do it if you let me organize a bone marrow drive when I'm there. And so through Survivor, I think I was able to organize around 70 or 80 bone marrow drives. And, you know, we ended up finding a match for two or three people who needed a match and otherwise may not have found it. So, you know, just thinking back to that experience, I thought, hey, maybe there's, you know, an opportunity to do something like that again for Stacy and Jonathan. I knew it was going to be a big season, you know, and it became pretty clear it was going to be an all winners thing. And I thought, look, if I go on the show and I get far enough, and if I were to just, you know, again, somehow win, then I might really be in a position to help in a way that I wouldn't have been able to do otherwise. So that was basically the main reason I went back on.
Yeah, I had done some reading up before we came on to talk, and yeah, I was really struck by, you know, the similarities between what you went through to try to get the bone marrow donations organized for your friend who passed away, and then the links that you're going through for bringing awareness for ALS research for Stacy Tidal.
Yeah, you know, Survivor is, I mean, it's entertainment, right? But at the same time, it really does give you an opportunity to try to highlight things that are really impactful, you know, and in this case, it just felt like, I mean, I'm not like a particularly religious person, but it just felt like the timing ended up in a really weird way, right? Mm-hmm. Where I was just trying to figure out, like, what could I do to try to help Jonathan and Stacy? And suddenly this thing comes up, you know, I honestly never thought I'd ever go back on Survivor. And weirdly, the circumstances kind of worked out too. Like I didn't think I was going to even be able to go back on. I'd started a new job, and you know, my wife was never really excited about the idea of might ever go back on. Mm-hmm. But weirdly, when I actually told her about it, I thought she was just going to.
Your wife, from what I watched some of your Ponderosa videos, I believe, and yeah. You ended up meeting your wife because of Survivor, correct?
I did.
Yes.
Yeah, totally. I got set up by Brad Verrata from yes. my season. On a blind date. So yeah, I, you know, Survivor's given me a lot, like, you know, I found a wife and I have kids, you know, all this stuff. But yeah, she was never thrilled at the idea that I would try to go back on. Like she, you know, there's always this kind of like hesitation around people go on reality shows. Like, are they really solid? Are they going to like, you know, go off and do something crazy? Mm-hmm. But I think, you know, over, I don't know how many years of marriage, I think she kind of got a sense of like, I wasn't going to go off and try to do something nuts. So yeah, when the opportunity came up, she was actually quite excited. And so, and then I talked to her about like my reasons for wanting to go back on, you know, with JC and Scott, but Stacy and Jonathan, and she was like totally supportive, and that totally made a difference for me.
Yeah. So Yul, can I ask you to touch on that? You talked about how that one of the reasons that you wanted to go on Survivor was that you felt like that Survivor had not done a great job with diversity casting. And that's certainly been something that's been very topical of late with there being petitions and all sorts of calls for Survivor to do a better job, both on camera and off camera, in terms of diversity casting and hiring. And I know that you have worked in government and worked at a lot of big companies. But do you feel like that there are some specific steps that Survivor in particular needs to still be taking at this time?
Yeah, I mean, so, you know, when I went on Survivor, as I mentioned, you know, one of the big motivations was just the fact that, like, growing up, I didn't see many people of color on television. And I think it had a pretty subtle but profound impact in terms of the way that I saw myself and saw what I could be. And, you know, I think having the absence of role models, you know, just seeing people from a community who just acted like ordinary Americans, right? And weren't kind of defined by their ethnicity. Like, it was just something I didn't see much of. Like, you know, growing up, whenever I saw television, in my case, like whenever I saw an Asian American man, they were typically like a kung fu master who couldn't speak English, you know, or like a computer geek who was just, you know, didn't lack social skills. And I never saw people from a community in a position where they were one, either just a normal person or much less kind of a leader, right? And I feel like, you know, the impact of that in any one instance is like small, but it's cumulative over time. And so I think in my own world, like I just never saw myself being anything other than this like shy person who was always marginalized and on the outside. I never felt a sense of belonging. And I certainly never imagined that I could like be a leader in any real sense. And so for me, it took me a very long time to develop any kind of confidence in myself. Like I don't know if you know this, but you know, growing up, I had a lot of social anxiety issues that I really struggled with, even well into my adulthood. You know, I had also been bullied a lot when I was a kid, and that left some pretty profound psychological challenges for me that I really, you know, even well into my adulthood, I just struggled to cope with. I'm happy to go into that if it'd be helpful, but you know, I think there are lots of reasons for this, but I do think that at least in some sense, the lack of these positive images in the media played a role in that. And so when I got the opportunity on Survivor, like they didn't tell us it was going to be a race war. And if I'd known, I definitely wouldn't have done it because I just think that's such a terrible idea. Mm-hmm. But, you know, I didn't know why they reached out, but I just figured, look, this is an opportunity for me to kind of represent my community And it's the kind of opportunity that probably doesn't happen very often, right? So I didn't feel like I'd be the best person to represent, but I mean, like, how often does anyone get this kind of chance? It was, to me at least, fairly clear during the casting process that they were recruiting on the basis of stereotypes. So in my case, I think I kind of fit in the kind of what, you know, the stereotype of the Asian geek or the nerd. And I think that's kind of what I was, you know, slotted in for. And I think if you look at the casting for Cook Islands, you can also see other people filling in some of these types of stereotypes, right? Like that you might see on television. And I really, like during the casting process, it really bothered me. I mean, when I went to the final round of casting, I saw that there was all these people of color, and I thought it was like, hey, this is terrific. Like, this is great. Like, well, like Seamus is really like forward looking. It didn't occur to me at the time that they would try to divide on the basis of race. I thought maybe what they would do is have tribes that had one representative of each ethnic community. Mm-hmm. That seemed to me like a pretty like thoughtful format that would get more diversity on television. You know, but during the casting process, again, it was fairly clear what role I thought I was being kind of targeted for. And, you know, I remember my final interview with Mark Burnett, man, like that was just kind of crazy. I don't know if he was trying to push my buttons, but he asked me a lot of questions that I kind of felt were a little bit like, you know, not fully PC, right? So he kept asking me, like, where are you from? Like, I'm from San Francisco. Like, no, where are you really from? I'm really from San Francisco. But, you know, if you're asking me where my parents are from, you know, my parents immigrated here from South Korea. You know, it just kind of went on like that. And again, I don't know if it was deliberate because he was trying to like see how I'd react to these types of questions. Mm-hmm. But it was very clear that race was kind of a clear underlying motive. So, yeah, I mean, I would say in general that Survivor Cook Islands, I think, was helpful in terms of just getting more people of color on television. And for that, I'm grateful. I think the premise under which they did it was something that, like, I thought was really dangerous and really risky. When they finally told us about the racial format, once we got to the island, I was thinking really hard about quitting. Mainly because I thought there are lots of different ways a show could end, and most of them I thought were just really bad. Like, so hypothetically, what if all the people of color got voted out by the white tribe? Like, that's clearly not going to send a very positive message. What if my tribe, the Asian tribe, ends up, like, wiping out everyone else? I mean, that I don't think is going to be something that's going to be moving race relations forward. But I figured, you know, even if I quit, like the show was still going to go on. And at least if I played, I might have some role in kind of shaping how the game plays out and what the final ending is going to be. And I, you know, I'm happy to, you know, I'm very gratified that ultimately things ended up telling a very positive story where race really didn't play a role in it. It was a multi-ethnic coalition of people who got to the end and got to the end without backstabbing each other. And then after the show, I had some conversations with CBS, and where I really tried to kind of encourage them to continue casting more diversity. Mm-hmm. For Fiji, I was happy to see that they did cast a lot of people of color, but I don't know if this is true, but my understanding had been that they had been considering doing the racial format again, but then someone kind of dropped out and said they didn't do it. But Fiji itself also had like a real diversity of different folks. But again, I don't think that was an accident. I think there was some consideration to having some sort of that racial theme again in some fashion. But then given the controversy that happened, I think maybe the first season, as well as the fact that I don't think they ended up having the right set of numbers, they ended up not having a racial thing. And I'd hope to see that general level of representation continue. And for the most part, it didn't. You know, I mean, in general, I think television has started moving, inching along incrementally, but we're still not where we need to be. So the fact that there has been this like outspoken effort, including from people from like Wendell and others that have been advocating for representation on Survivor, I think it's a wonderful thing. It's long overdue.
Okay. Well, I appreciate you weighing in on this because, you know, it's extremely very topical when we're talking about Survivor. Yul, I also just wanted to make sure that, you know, we were talking about Jonathan and Stacey, but I did not ask you if there were any links or anything that you want to point people to in terms of, you know, still continuing to fundraise for Jonathan and Stacey and ALS.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, the campaign has actually gone really well, much better than I think where Jonathan had been hoping for, especially because we launched a campaign in the middle of the coronavirus epidemic, right? Our pandemic. Would love for people to continue giving. You know, it's not too late, especially if you were thinking about it and you haven't done it already. Please go to cbs.com/survivoralsinfo. There you can find out more information about Stacey and Jonathan, what they've been going through, and there's a link that you can use to donate. We've raised to to date over $250,000. So, and we've had over 2,500 donors, which has been pretty remarkable. I'm so grateful to all the fans out there, people in the Survivor Nation who've been giving. You know, on Reddit, there was like an organized campaign where people were trying to rally, and really has made a difference, both financially. Like, we raised quite a bit of money, but I think just the emotional support that Jonathan and Stacey have seen. I mean, there have been so many people who've written to them expressing their love and their support. And, you know, in times like this, it's easy to just feel alone and isolated. And I think it's really, really helped them. And I was just glad that Stacey was able to see the entire season and to see the outpouring of support and love that she received. So yeah, for anyone who's watching this, if you haven't donated, please consider donating. You know, every dollar counts. ALS is something that I think we can beat. I mean, I've talked to a number of the ALS researchers out there, including ones that Jonathan and Stacey have been close to, and they think that a cure is on the horizon. And, you know, the thing that's really been a big motivation for me is just, you know, Stacey has a genetic version of ALS where she has a genetic disorder that is inheritable. And so their children have a 50% chance of having the same condition or same genetic disorder that leads to ALS. And it's really for them that I think we're all trying to pull for, right? It's not too late for them. In Stacey's case, it's unfortunately a terminal disease, and she's getting close to the point where she's lost any ability to communicate. I mean, right now she can't move any part of her body except for her eyes, and they're the only things that she uses to communicate. And even that ability is slowly fading. And, you know, Jonathan and Stacey, I think, have agreed that if she ever gets to the point where she can't communicate at all in any fashion, that's going to be the end. And they'll discontinue life support. So in her case, it's already a foregone conclusion. And I think what we're hoping to do is just help these last, you know, few moments for her be special, because she realized how much people really care for her and her family. But the more practical thing that we're trying to do is to help accelerate the race for a cure. And it's not too late. I think there is a very good possibility that in the next few years there might be some real therapeutic options out there that will help people with ALS, especially people who have this genetic version of it.
Can I ask, what does a cure look like? Is it a vaccine?
No, it's probably some sort of like genetic therapy, right? Okay. So it actually, you know, the genetic version of it is the one that's really scary because it is inheritable. That seems to be the one that has a higher chance of potentially having some sort of therapy that can either not entirely eliminate, perhaps, but at least kind of inhibit the expression of ALS for people who have that genetic disorder. So yeah, I talked to one of the kind of leading researchers, and she's relatively optimistic that in the next like 4 to 5 years, something could be there. And then over time, for people who have the non-genetic version of ALS, you know, hopefully there'll be some real hope for them too.
Okay. I'd love to hear about your experience with Survivor this past season. And, you know, when we get to hear you talk, like, you know, it's, you know, so clear, like, how thoughtful you are about everything. I have to imagine that a lot of planning went into your return to Survivor. Once you agreed to say yes, the wheels must have been in motion in terms of, like, formulating, you know, did you have a big strategy coming into the game?
Yeah. So, you know, I'll be pretty forthright about what went through my own head. So once I got the call, I thought it was unlikely I was going to do it for lots of different reasons. And then, you know, once my wife expressed support and once I realized, hey, this is something I could actually use to try to help Jonathan and Stacey, and I talked to them about it, and obviously I wanted their permission. I wanted to have their blessing to make sure they would feel comfortable with me talking about this. And they were just wildly enthusiastic. They're like, we want to get the story out. We want to do anything to like provide help, especially you know, if there's any chance of it helping our kids. So once I made the decision to do it, I'm like, then I started getting really kind of like, wait, how am I going to have any shot of like getting blown out immediately? Like I've been completely disconnected for like years. I hadn't even been watching the show for many seasons. And I knew that a lot of people it was fairly clear. And I figured, you know, if they invited me back, it's probably going to be an all-winners thing because I don't think they would otherwise invite me back. And, you know, came pretty clear if you just kind of read stuff that was pretty much what was happening. And I thought, like, look, I'm going to have, like, no shot of getting ahead. Like, all these people are coming back. have either played multiple times or have played more recently than I have and have probably kind of stayed connected with each other. So I really thought, and you know, I talked to the casting director about this and just, you know, is there any point in me going back at all? Because if I just go and I'm like, all these other people already know each other and I'm the odd man out, then like, it's not going to be very impactful and I'm just going to end up kind of wasting a lot of time. So I thought about it and I was like, okay, look, if I'm going to do this, I want to at least try to make sure like I'm as much of a even playing field as possible. So I figured, okay, if I'm going to do this and if I'm doing this, especially for Jonathan and Stacey, like I'm just going to do my absolute best.
Yeah.
So, you know, I started trying to think, okay, I'm pretty disconnected from folks. There may be a couple of folks I still stay in touch with, obviously Jonathan and some other people. But what ended up happening was, just over time, so I reached out to a couple of people that I knew, who were more part of the community, right? So a couple of like friends who, so it's more kind of like, I didn't really know people directly, but I knew people who kind of knew people. And so when I reached out, they were offering to help. And then I started finding that other people started reaching out to me and saying, offering to help out as well. There was one specific conversation that I remember in particular. I won't mention the person's name, but it's another former winner. But I haven't asked them whether it'd be okay for me to share their name. So I'll keep that mood. But the person basically told, like, reached out to me and said, hey, like, what are you doing to prepare? I'm like, I don't know what I should be doing. I'm trying to watch as many seasons as I can. And I'm trying to like read Reddit and figure out what the heck's been going on for the last like 13 years. And the person basically told me like, you know, I remember this very distinctly, like, get your head out of your ass and get your head in the game. The game's already started. I'm like, what do you mean? It's like, look, everyone's already like, you know, they know each other and there's lots of chatter going on. And if you're just like completely out of it, then you're going to have no shots. I'm like, oh my God, like, whoa, like, so what should I be doing? And so that person started connecting me with other folks. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, my general policy was, you know, I figured that because I was so out of it, you know, and it wouldn't really help Jonathan Stacey if I was like the first one voted out.
Yeah.
My general posture was like, if anyone reaches out to me or expresses any interest in working together, then I'd be, you know, silly not to, you know, to say no. Like the worst thing would be if anyone expressed interest in it were to be like, no, I'm not going to talk to you. I'm not going to work with you. That itself could be a reason that people would try to vote me out later on. So yeah. So basically over time, I started getting connected with other folks. Either they reached out or I got connected through other people. And there was, you know, from what I could gather, quite a bit of this happening.
Like, yeah.
You know, there are obviously a lot of people who had already known each other and played a bunch of times and were friends. And there, so it was very clear that there was a lot of chatter happening. And so I basically tried to put myself in the best position I could just so that like when I got onto the island on day one, I wouldn't get immediately voted out because mm-hmm. I was like the odd person out.
Yul, did you find that some of this, pre-game chatter and conversation, were these conversations useful in, going back out there, or did they really just like kind of put you at ease a little bit before the game, but were not actually meaningful when you got out on the beach?
I would say looking back, it gave me a little bit of more peace of mind, just knowing that like I wasn't completely like, you know, disconnected, that mm-hmm. there were at least people that I had some level of familiarity with. I didn't know how helpful it would be because the reality is, you know, most of these people have known each other for years, right? And I wasn't sure whether any amount of like chatter in like the week or two before you go onto the game would trump any of those kind of mm-hmm. relationships that had a lot more longevity, especially people played with each other, because that's a much more intense experience. You're actually together. As it turned out in retrospect, I don't think it helped me. And I don't think it had that much of a huge impact on the game, because I think in my case, what ended up happening was what I'd suspected was did end up happening, which is people who known each other for a longer period of time, those relationships trumped anything that like any chatter that might've happened beforehand. Mm-hmm. So for example, when I got voted out, you know, it was basically me, Wendell, Michelle, and Nick. And the reality is those three knew each other and have history together. And mm-hmm. that trumped anything that I think might have been, you know, happened in the week or two before the game started.
Yeah.
So, you know, I've tried to catch up a little bit on what people have said. And I know people have asked, like, when, and I'm happy to go into detail. So if you want to go in chronological order, I'm happy to do that. But in that case, I think people have been asking, why didn't I try to align with Parvati? And I think that was, you know, probably not really an option. I think as soon as the tribes got split, I think the Wendell, Michelle, and Nick, because they had known each other and they were friends. I think that pretty much would have trumped anything. Mm-hmm. So in my case, I knew that they were friends. So it was clear. So from in my mind at the time, what I was thinking was, if I tried to land with Parvi, like who would we even try to pull in? Like Nick wouldn't come over. Wendell mm-hmm. wouldn't come over. Michelle obviously was still tight with Wendell and Nick. So to me, it seemed like that was not really an option. Like it would seem still, because I was fully expecting the merge was going to happen. Like if you look at,
yeah.
I don't know how many years of Survivor, the merge always happens with like 13 people around, 13. Right? So I was like pretty, you know, again, they can always change things, but like, you know, like it seemed unlikely they would change that format. So I thought like I was basically good for the merge, you know, and it would seem silly for me to like kind of go against my core alliance to try to like work with Parvi if I thought we were going to merge anyways, because then it would just screw me over after the merge. Mm-hmm. So, yeah. So anyway, I guess long story short, I feel like there was pre-gaming going on. I don't think it actually helped me, because I think the thing that I had feared would be true, at least in my case, ended up being true, which is people who did know each other for a longer period of time, those relationships trumped anything that happened beforehand.
Yeah.
So, yeah.
Well, I'd love to hear more about the early days of the game for you at Dakar, where you were sort of like seen as like the person who was spearheading this group of the people that don't have connections. We're sort of like the yeah. one-time players who we don't know a ton of people. And so this is going to be our group. Was that sort of your plan coming in of like, okay, I'm going to try to find all the one-time players and get them together?
Pretty much, yeah. I mean, I had this kind of elaborate strategy going into that, and I was trying to figure out, like, what are the different scenarios that would happen? Like, you can imagine you go in, and then there's already, like... So, like, my biggest fear was that there would be this, like, alliance of all the people who played before, and, like, there's literally nothing you could do if you're on the outs of that. They had this kind of tight group, and you get voted out. If that happened, you know, there's probably nothing I could do mm-hmm. anyways. But I was thinking, okay, if I ended up in a tribe where there was like an alliance of there, like say there were like two major alliances, then what I would try to do is either, if none of those were big enough to have a dominant kind of coalition, try to see if I could form an alliance in the middle of people who are not super affiliated and see if that would actually be able to be the swing vote that would control. Or if that wasn't the case, try to insinuate myself into one of these alliances and kind of play the card of like, hey, I'm disconnected, I haven't played forever, I'll be a loyal foot soldier, and then try to see if there are any kind of cracks. But as it turned out, it ended up becoming more that first scenario where there was a clear sort of alliance forming between Tyson and Amber and Kim. And then on the other hand, there was obviously the power duo of Sarah and Tony. And then there was like this kind of group of folks kind of in the middle who were just sort of like not clearly aligned one way or the other. And it became pretty apparent that like that could actually become the dominant swing vote in any kind of, and mm-hmm. the great thing about, you know, the thing that kind of kills me is like, I felt like in the first few weeks, I felt like I was in like such a great position. Mm-hmm. Like I basically had like alliances with pretty much everyone. I felt like I was helping to orchestrate the votes, you know, in a way that wasn't like too obvious. I mean, over time, I think it became a little bit more apparent. But I felt like I actually had really good relationships with pretty much everyone in the tribe. And everyone for the most part, thought I was in alliance with them, right? So I felt like I had a maximum range of options. I had that core alliance with Sophie and Wendell and Nick. I also had a good relationship with Kim, who was yes. getting close with Sophie. So Kim, Sophie, and I had decided that we would try to work together. So there was that. I also had a really good relationship with Tony and Sarah. Sarah and I were actually in alliance. Mm-hmm. She had this thing where when I started talking about that, especially that emotional kind of moment where I started talking about Jonathan and Stacey, she came up and reached out to me afterwards and we had this really deep conversation. And she basically said, like, I didn't realize how bad things were for them. And I will commit and I will pledge that if I win, I donate 10% of my winnings to support them in ALS wow. research. And I was like, wow, like, and I didn't know if it was true or not. I did feel like she was sincere, and she said it on camera, and she said it enough times on camera. Mm-hmm. Didn't show all the stuff, but she said enough times. I felt like it'd be really hard for her to like backtrack on that now. She also, to my understanding, donated 10% of her winnings for the first time, I think, through her church. So I knew that she had done this before. So from yeah. that point on, I told Sarah, like, Sarah, like, I am locked in with you. Like, if I'm not going to win, I'll do everything I can to help you win, because I would, you know, that's the whole reason, you know, I went on the show. Mm-hmm. So I had a good, relationship with her, and also built an alliance with Tony.
Yeah.
I also had an alliance with Sandro. So I felt like this could not be going any better. Yeah. I have like maximum range of options and, yeah. And so, you know, there's a lot of stuff that obviously didn't kind of work out the way that it moved. I think the tribe swap, you know, again, looking back, I mean, maybe there are different things I could have done, but I honestly do think that at the point that we had the tribe swap, there was probably not much I could do.
Yeah.
Right. I think the Wendell, Michelle.
Let's get there. Let's not jump to the dessert, Yule. Let's savor this. We're talking about the glory days here. We didn't even talk about breadfruit or Tony's ladder or anything. The shark. Yeah. This is all very interesting. Just to go back to what you were saying with Sarah, I guess jump ahead a little bit. If Sarah was in the end with Tony, would you have voted for Sarah after she said that to you about how she would pledge the money to ALS?
It wouldn't be 100%. It would, you know, again, I do want to play, or, you know, for me, I feel like the role of the jury is obviously critically important, and I'd want to do what I felt was sort of my duty to make sure that the person who won deserved to win. So I wouldn't say it was an automatic vote for her, but if she played a strong game and it was like close, and certainly this would be a big thumb on that side of the scale.
Yeah.
But again, if I felt like she had played a terrible game, then it would be hard to do that. Like I don't know if everyone felt this way, but I know I and certainly some other people felt like whoever wins this season, this is kind of a different season. It's a special season. Whoever wins this represents all of us, and doesn't just represent all of us, but represents all the survivor, right? So you really want the person who wins to be someone that you could feel proud of and feel like, yeah, this person deserved to win and is like the, you know, the winner among winners. And by the way, for what it's worth, I do feel like that person was Tony. I think Tony played an amazing game. Like, he absolutely deserved to win. But I think that would have been going in my head if it had come down to Tony and Sarah. So not a lot, but certainly in my case, it would have been a big factor.
I know you had all these different relationships going on in the early days of Dekal. Did you have one particular relationship or group that you felt the strongest about?
So that's a good question. Like, you know, I was tight with Sophie and I trusted her, and I thought we would have gone far together. I also had the alliance with Wendell and Nick. And my intention was to like try to go all the way to the end with that group and potentially Michelle as well. And it, I honestly was not planning to backstab people. I wanted to try to get as far as I could. There were things that happened over time that started make me a little bit less sure about Nick and Wendell. I think in Wendell's case, by the way, I think Wendell's an amazing human being.
Sure.
So I love him to death. He and I really bonded because I think we do have very similar views on things like race relations. I think we're both committed to trying to do things outside the confines of the game itself that I feel like are important things. I do also think he got a pretty, you know, rough edit. Like, they did make him into a villain. That said, there were things, you know, he did that started making me feel more nervous about him. You know, in the tribal council, you know, that first tribal council where he kind of, I can't remember, I mean, it's been so long ago, but there were a couple of tribal councils where he sort of went off script, right? Mm-hmm. And started saying things that kind of everyone were like, wait, what's going on? What are you saying here? And, you know, I think it also culminated in that thing where when Parvati got voted out, he said, make me an offer, you know, things like that.
Yeah.
That really started making me and others feel like, wait a second, like, is he really committed to this, or is he going to potentially kind of blow things up at some point? So that started making me a little bit more sure of him. And then on the Nick side of things too, like I felt like with Nick, I went out of my way to protect him. They didn't show this on the show. There are a number of things that happened where people are targeting Nick, and I kind of really kind of try to go out of my way to kind of move the vote towards a different target. A lot of the reasons actually that we did target specific people was in part to kind of protect him and other folks. Mm-hmm. But I also felt like he wasn't really helping because he would, you know, just not do things around camp. It just made him in such an obvious target, you know, where he would be perceived as not really helping out and just, you know, and I said this, like, he just consumes everything. Mm-hmm. Obviously I kind of exaggerated in that situation, but he did eat a lot. And so I started wondering, like long term, are these people that I can really rely on as allies? Like, are they, you know, even if they don't intentionally backstab me, like, are they just going to kind of do something to kind of blow things up? But yeah, at least at that point in time, my core alliance was Sophie, Nick, Wendell, and who else was on my tribe? I also had a good relationship with Sandra. Like, she always told me I was her number one. I kind of didn't believe her, you know, because it just seemed incredible. I was incredulous that Sandra, who's like, you know, the queen, knows all these people, would pick me to be her number one. So I always took that with a grain of salt. As it turned out, I think it was actually true. But so yeah, and I, you know, as long as she didn't kind of turn on me, I think I probably would stay close to her.
Yul, what do you look for in an ally? You've worked with a lot of different people. Is there like one particular skill set that you find that you work best with on Survivor?
Yeah, that's a good question. I would say it's two things. One is, you know, I like playing with rational people, right? Like, if they're irrational, it's very hard to work with them because there's no predictability. As long as they're a rational player, you can at least know like how long they're likely to stay with you. And you know, I would, you know, I don't know if there was like, I made a lot of mistakes obviously on the season. But I, for me, again, I don't want to jump to the dessert in your words, but
yeah, I don't want to hold you back either though. If you want to go there.
Okay. When I got voted out, I thought the clearly obviously rational thing to do was to keep that alliance together.
Yes.
Because it seemed obvious to me that if I got voted out, then whoever stayed would lose control, because at that point, then it would have kind of been a free for all. So yeah, so for me, I think I look for people who are very thoughtful, rational people.
Yes.
Even if you know that they're self-interested, you can at least try to align the incentives in such a way that there's some predictability about how far you'll go forward together. The other thing I try to look for are people who, I don't know, are kind of playing for something maybe a little bit outside just the game itself.
Mm-hmm.
Like I think most on a personal level, I tend to resonate with people like that. And also, you know, for example, like in Cook Islands, like one of the reasons I was such good friends with Becky and trusted her so much was she was a domestic violence attorney. Like, she could have, after law school, worked at lots of different law firms, but she was on the show because she wanted to help people and she started a nonprofit. I mean, she told me that was what she was going to do, to help victims of domestic violence. Like, people like that I tend to gravitate to, just on a personal level, as well as they're probably not going to do something that's so reprehensible on television that it's going to blow up their larger views and scrutiny on the show, right? So people who have solid careers, where if they do something really slimy and despicable, or, you know, say some, give a racial epithet or something like that, they're probably going to get canned, right? They're probably not going to do something crazy like that. Or like really good, upstanding members of the community who have a reputation, or like really devoted family people who probably would not want to do something that they'd be ashamed to have their children see. So those are the kind of people I generally try to align with.
Okay. Can you talk a little bit about the quest for breadfruit and how much you became associated with it, to the point where you could even just tweet the word breadfruit and retweets, favorites, incredible social media phenomenon?
That was the craziest thing. I've been out of social media for so long. Like, I don't know how the breadfruit thing and the Yule meme. I'm like, what? What is going on? Like, apparently these long chains of people just writing my name down.
If I could try to explain it, not to say that, you know, I know what goes through the minds of teenagers, but that people are just so excited to have you back on the screen that I think that there are sometimes with in the world of Survivor that we have these iconic players and characters such as yourself, and then you also at the same time, in addition to having, you know, this great experience with Survivor, then you go back to your real life and you're not really part of this Survivor community. So like a family member who like, oh, did you hear Yule's come to Thanksgiving this year? Oh my God, this is incredible. You know, we don't see you all the time. And I think that people also realize just how busy you are. And so how rare it is to have you here. So the idea that you were going to be back for this season, I think a lot of people thought that, hey, we'll never see Yule back on Survivor. So that there was just just this, you know, tangible excitement to have you back on a Survivor in a way where somebody like Rob, who's been, has been on the show six times, including, you know, the last season where him and Sandra were just back, you know, way that if, you know, and maybe had, you know, Rob just come back for this season and hadn't already been back for the previous season, you know, people would have that type of excitement to see him back. But for you, we never thought it would happen again. I think the people just lost their minds.
That's really sweet. I got to say, I was so, I don't know, happy to see that when I came back, like, it was such a positive response. I honestly did not expect it. I really thought I'd never be invited back on the show. And I honestly didn't know if anyone would even remember who I was.
Yeah.
So yeah, it was really, I don't know. It really kind of warmed my heart. I didn't expect it. I came back prepared thinking like, I'm just going to get torn apart, you know, just like everyone does on social media. But for the most part, like, I found a lot of like support and a lot of love, and it just made it such a positive experience for me. So I'm incredibly grateful to all the people out there and the fans. And yeah, and if the Yule thing and the breadfruit thing is an expression of that, like, that's even sweeter. Like, incredibly kind.
Yes.
Although weird.
Yeah,
the breadfruit thing, we spent a lot of time getting breadfruit. Like, you know, there's not a lot of food on this show, and there are these like very large breadfruit trees, and we couldn't figure out how to get them. And so I took one approach, Tony took another approach. It was funny how they kind of played up the two different approaches. I ended up eventually finding a thing that worked really well. Like, I had this pole and I got this piece of wire and I was able to get like all the breadfruit that we wanted. Mm-hmm. Tony, I think, was able to create this ginormous ladder that almost got everyone killed. but I also think, again, to his credit, I think this was all strategic on his part.
Yeah.
You know, I think he was trying to be taken not as seriously as kind of goofy, you know, turned his unpredictability and erraticness from a liability into a positive.
Yeah.
Like, saw that in an endearing quality. And I think it worked really well. Like, he, again, played a masterful game.
You would have to agree with that. When I talked with Tony, he said that he knew the ladder was bad. He said he knew that this was a terrible idea.
It was obviously bad. I mean...
But he said he did
it. There's
no way
to look at that ladder and think, oh my God, this thing is not going to fall apart.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And it worked. You said about Tony at the next tribal council that you guys would go to that you thought that Tony would be an a-hole when you got there, which I thought was kind of frank coming from you. Can you talk about how Tony was different than your expectation?
Yeah, totally. I think more than anyone else, Tony really kind of shattered my kind of pre-existing kind of preconception of him. He, you know, just from watching him play, like, the challenge for me is like, there was literally no way I could watch every single season before I went back on. I calculated that if I spent 8 hours a day watching Survivor, like, I wasn't going to be able to get, you know, watch everything before I went. So I had to be very selective in what I did it. And, you know, Tony was one of the people I kind of focused on because I knew that he was going to be a big personality and a big force within the game. And, you know, just seeing how he played and what people said about him, I just assumed he was going to be a jerk. It's going to be kind of this weird wild man who's erratic and self-interested. I just thought he was going to be, you know, an asshole. The reality was very different. Like, I could see the craziness about him, but no, he's incredibly devoted to his family. He was very, very kind of trying to be supportive and enduring. We had lots of really good conversations. And, you know, I don't know. I think what it is that there are obviously different dimensions to people. And I did definitely see parts of him where if you started looking for idols, or you threw his name out, he'd just go into berserker mode. But outside of that, he's actually a really warm, compassionate, genuine human being. And I realized that a lot of what you saw in other seasons didn't necessarily reflect who he was as a person. So I think the world of Tony. I think he's a really genuinely kind person who cares so much about his family and his friends. And it's just, it was kind of special to have that time. Like, I don't know if other people have said, but that time with DeKal before this trial happened was actually a really good time. I think for the most part, we really enjoyed ourselves and got to know each other. And it wasn't like this, I mean, everyone's playing, but it wasn't this like super cutthroat kind of thing. And that's something that I really kind of valued from that season. I felt like I got to know some really special people.
Well, I had seen one of the producers, Joe Leah, had tweeted about that those days on Decal were some of the most fun that he had being out on. And there's like such great secret scenes. You have a ton of great characters. It seems like a really fun group, while the other tribe is really like the train wreck tribe. It seems like that you guys really had your act together.
We did. It was, you know, most of the votes were fairly unanimous. Like, it wasn't like everyone got their way, but everyone kind of knew what it was. So there was a relatively minimal amount of like running around and acting crazy. And there was some of that. Obviously, it's unavoidable. But for the most part, I think people really enjoyed the time. And for me, it was kind of special. Like, I gotta say, Cook Islands was not the most fun thing. I felt like, because of the racial twist, I felt like I had to walk on eggshells. And that was very, very conscious of that. And, you know, parts of the game just got very negative. And it was just, you know, one of the things I told myself is, when I go back, I'm just going to speak much more freely. I'm not going to self-censor myself. And so in my confessionals, I think I was a lot more candid in terms of my thoughts. And I'm just going to try to enjoy the experience. It's probably like the last time I'm going to do this again. So, like, I really kind of like want to enjoy it for what it's worth. And I think we did, at least for a short period of time. Edge of Extinction, of course, was completely different, but the call was pretty cool.
So in Cook Islands, you were probably spoiled by Ozzy catching so much fish. You guys had to ultimately deal with a shark on your beach over at the call. Could you talk about the encounter with the shark?
Yeah, we did pretty well in the call. So, you know, I got pretty handy with the breadfruit. So I was able to catch it or collect at least like 3 or 4 breadfruit a day. Or maybe every couple of days. You know, we had this big net and Sandra decided we should deploy the net. And so we kind of helped her with that. And then that net was just like, you know, the source of bounty. Like every single morning we'd wake up. Yeah. I don't think it's just coincidence though, because we struck up the net in the area of, I don't want to get too gross about this, but okay. So one innovation or change since I was on Survivor was where you went to the bathroom.
Yeah.
So on Cook Islands, you know, the guidance was you dig a hole. And we call it Coconut Grove. And then you try to cover it up and put a stick or rock in it so people know. And I don't know if they changed it after my season.
There is a very effective bait being used in Fiji.
Exactly. Pretty much. Yeah.
Oh, no.
So we struck up the net right when we went to the bathroom in the water this time. Now the thing is, like, you're supposed to do an aqueduct. Which I never got the hang of, to be quite honest. It just never, I don't know, it was too weird.
I think it would be tough.
But anyway, most people, so I don't know if that bait helped, but certainly I don't think it hurt. And every morning we caught something nice and tasty, including that shark.
Okay. All right, now people have a great tip. Could you talk a little bit about, so ultimately, you guys are going to vote out Tyson when you go back to Tribal Council. We saw in the episodes, it seemed like that, you know, we see Tyson talking to you. We see Tyson talking with Tony about the potentially trying to save Tyson. Were you trying to ultimately pit Sandra and Tyson against each other in the conversations that you had with them?
Sorry, which episode is this the one that where we're led to the Amber vote?
Well, we're going to know after Amber goes home. It seems like there's some conversation where Tyson wants to target Sandra, but also at the same time that Tyson is talking to... Tyson had mentioned Sandra's name, but you told Sandra that Tyson was talking about her. It seems like that Sandra never wants to get back on board with potentially saving Tyson when Tony and Sarah want to. Were you trying to pit them against each other, or were things just sort of like edited over the course of 2 weeks?
I'm trying to remember the sequence of events, because one, it happened so long ago, it was kind of hazy, and two, I think they did quite a bit of editing to kind of put things in different orders.
Well, talk about your feelings about that vote? Why was it important for Tyson to go next?
Yeah, I think what basically happened was, you know, in the first vote with Amber, so Tony wanted to target Tyson, and I convinced him to go for Amber for a number of different reasons. Mm-hmm. One was, in Tony's world, I think he was planning to split the vote to have the second vote land on Nick. And in a world where Tyson potentially had an idol, then one of my allies potentially would go home.
Okay.
So that's something I didn't want. I also thought it was more likely that Tyson, if anyone was going to have found an idol, it was more likely to be Tyson than Amber. Simply because, you know, Tyson, I think, had played multiple times, including more recently where there were Hidden Mini Idols. Ember had played like, you know, relatively long time ago. Mm-hmm. I saw Tyson kind of moving around a lot more, so I thought it'd be more likely he'd actually gone looking for an idol. And, you know, again, there's this very weird statistical anomaly or imbalance. And I do think this actually is not a good thing. But, you know, I think the way the Hidden Media Idols work, it tends to favor men for the most part. Like a vast majority of these have been found by men. So just looking at the numbers, I thought it was more likely that Tyson might potentially have an idol. And you know, again, I didn't think it was likely, but if he did, then I didn't want my ally Nick going home. So I kind of convinced Tony to go for Tyson. After that, but I also gave Tyson information beforehand, letting him know, as well as Kim. Like, if you know the vote's going to go a certain way, then you can use that as an opportunity to try to build a relationship with the other people. And I thought it would be good to have Tyson kind of, you know, to build a relationship with him for a couple of reasons. One, we never knew how things are going to end up. I also thought that at some point, if there was a merge or tribe swap happened, where he would obviously be allied with, like, Rob, you know, and other folks that he knew, I wanted to at least have somebody I could potentially work with to kind of sponsor me to Rob and kind of tell him, like, actually, don't get rid of Buell, like, we can work with him. The thing that ended up kind of ended up having the target on Tyson's back was really the thing that really did it was at some point it became clear he was trying to get the big names like Tony and Sarah and Sandra to target the kind of people in the middle. And so once he started throwing out those names, I think he at some point threw out Nick or Sophie, and at some point my name had come up.
Yeah.
At that point, it was pretty much, okay, look, at this point, like we have. And I actually tried to give Tyson another shot. Like when I first heard about this, I went to him directly and I said, hey, I've been hearing that I thought we were good. I thought we were actually going to be trying to work together. But I've been hearing you've been throwing out these other names. And then at that point, I think he said he wouldn't do it. But then I started hearing he kept on trying to organize this alliance. So I think that was the thing that really ended up solidifying the vote against him. Because once he started, once I wasn't clear that he was going to be targeting me or the alliance I had, obviously then that pretty much determines the outcome, right? Like if I want to work with Tyson, which I really hope to, I think Tyson's an amazing guy. Like I respect him tremendously as a competitor. He's an incredible challenge competitor. He's by far the strongest swimmer you know, I've ever seen compete. I think he and Ozzy
stronger than Ozzy
definitely be able to go ahead and possibly. Tyson's an elite swimmer. He's really, really good. He's also very strategic, and I also really enjoyed getting to know him. Like, he's a really deep thinker.
Yes.
You know, like he obviously very funny, but he also has a side to him that's like incredibly thoughtful and very deep. Mm-hmm. So I actually did hope to hopefully work with him. Like, I thought there was some world where we could go forward together. But then once it started, it became clear he was trying to organize this other alliance. At that point, it was kind of like, obviously he has to go.
What Sophie had told me was that she was saying that your group, or at least from her perspective, what she was hoping to do was, okay, we took out, we took out Amber from the quote unquote, like poker alliance. And now let's take out Tony from that other group and let's try to potentially weaken both sides. Yeah. But she said at that point it was coming out where Tyson had been looking to target your group in the middle, then that wasn't going to be something that worked for that group.
Yeah, I think that's right. I mean, I don't think we had made any final determination, but at that point, the thinking was probably to get rid of Tony because we knew Tony was an incredible threat. Like he was, you know, again, everyone knew that he was a big name coming in. And the fact that he and Sarah were obviously friends, I mean, they would try to deny it, but I mean, clearly they, you know, had a thing going on. So if things hadn't changed, if Tyson hadn't started targeting us, and I think more likely than not, it probably would have been Tony going home, you know, which obviously would have changed the entire game, right? Just curious to see how things would have played out differently.
Yeah. One more question.
This
early part of the game, the Poker Alliance, what was the Poker Alliance actually something? Were you actually concerned about that group of people that went to go play in that poker game? Or was the Poker Alliance just sort of like a red herring to sort of, be able to throw names out there and get the target off of people like yourself?
I would say it's probably both, right?
Yeah.
So I think the Poker Alliance thing, I didn't know if it was a real thing or not. I mean, I thought it certainly could be. It seemed entirely plausible. Mm-hmm. And know, again, there was that kind of statement that Tyson had made, which, by the way, I cannot claim credit for that. I mean, I was sent that by a super fan who I'd gotten connected to, who was basically trying to like help me out, right? So I think you know him, Alex Fortenhausler.
Yes. Yeah, he has a big role in Survivor history. He's been mentioned many a times in different seasons. He was the person that was the connection between Zeke and Andrea. I worked on a project with him called Reality Game Master. So he's no stranger to this podcast.
Yeah, yeah. So Alex, and there was another friend, Liska Savage, who are, I think, both super fans. And I had kind of connected to them through kind of other folks. And then they had just shared.
And they were like, hey, watch out for this, because these people went on TV and they said they were going to be an alliance.
Yeah, I think, I knew that a lot of people played poker together. So there was a thing. I remember hearing, just even on my own, because once I started getting out, I was just kind of looking around, and I remember hearing like a number of people play poker together. I'd heard like Adam was trying to become like a professional poker player or something like that. But that was something that I think was pretty well known, like that people seem to think. But I think Alex was the one who actually found that particular video and shared it. And so when I saw that, I was like, oh man, maybe this really is a thing. So I would say I was substantively concerned. I really did think, well, clearly, like if, you know, this just happens to be kind of a something that made it on YouTube or television or something like that. You can imagine there probably have been a lot more conversations that might have happened, you know, in kind of hidden doors. So I thought that could be a thing, but even if it wasn't the thing, it didn't matter, right? Because as long as it was a thing that seemed like it could be a thing, in this game, perception is the most important thing, then it would be one reason to be able to kind of put a target on another group of folks. Yeah. So whether it's true or not, for purposes of the game, it didn't necessarily matter.
Okay.
But I thought more likely than not, I thought there was probably something to it. I knew that Rob and Tyson were obviously friends. Rob and Amber are obviously married. Mm-hmm. Kim didn't really know, but Kim was interesting because she came in with a very strong reputation. She played perhaps the single best season of Survivor for like a one-time winner. She could have come in as one of the disconnected people. I think that was kind of the assumption that she'd also been like similar to a lot of us, like we played one time. It didn't seem like you were super engaged, but then people knew that she had been in that poker game. And more than anything else, it wasn't that so much as the fact that once the game started, she spent a lot of time with Amber and Tyson.
Right.
And, you know, I think most people just assumed, okay, clearly they must have had some sort of pre-existing relationship because they were such a tight bond. After we voted out Amber, I think it was actually when we first told Kim that it was going to be Amber who was going to go. I remember approaching her and trying to offer some observations or advice, which was like, hey, I think the fact that you're spending so much time with Amber is in some ways kind of putting a target on your back, especially because you had been in this poker video as well. And I believe her. I think what she said was it wasn't any kind of like strategy. I think what was happening was that both she and Amber were really having a hard time being apart from their kids, you know, and which is totally legitimate and genuine. And I think they found comfort in each other because they're both going through the same thing.
Yeah.
So I don't think there was anything strategic about it, but in terms of the game itself, I think that ended up putting a target on her back because people just assumed clearly she's aligned with Amber and Tyson, and it leads credence to this idea that maybe she had something going on with Tyson because of the poker thing.
Okay, Yul, let's get to this swap that is ultimately where you're going to run into a major problem in the game. So when you got to this group, you probably were excited, right? To be with Nick and Wendell and Michelle and Parvati.
Yeah, I was very excited. I was thinking, man, this could not have worked out any better.
Mm-hmm.
But what did I know?
Well, okay. So you mentioned about how, you know, that you didn't think that you were going to be able to get something going with Parvati. And if so, then what? I guess the one part of this that we haven't really talked about is that you had a very good relationship with Michelle coming into the game, right?
Right. Yep.
Because I
would say it's not like we knew each other very long, but she was one of the people that I had gotten connected with through like a mutual person. And then we ended up spending time together talking about, like, hey, if we're going to be in this game together, like, we should work together, yeah, that kind of stuff. It wasn't like we had known each other for a long time.
Right,
like a couple of weeks before we actually left for the show.
Because in my conversation with Michelle, and I don't believe that you know this unless she has expressed this to you, but that she said, I had asked her, Michelle, what was your biggest regret of the entire game? And she said, because I had basically had asked her about how, you know, she had all these other allies over the course of the game, but nobody was upfront with her. Nobody, that every one of her allies said, yeah, we're good. But then they were all freelancing and doing other things and keeping things from her. And I had asked her about that, you know, was there one person that was your best ally? And she said it was Yule. And that was her biggest regret of the game. To vote you out, because I think it would have changed so many things for her to keep you in the game.
Yeah. Both Michelle and Nick have said the same to me. Look, I mean, I'm obviously biased here. I do think it was.
You think that they should have kept
mistake.
You also? Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, I guess. I mean, again, this is one of the things where I feel like having prior relationships for a longer period of time ultimately trump whatever chatter might happen in the game. Like, I don't know if anything could have changed. I mean, at the point that the swap happened, I thought I was ecstatic because I thought, okay, this definitely means I've made the merge, right? Like, we would have one more vote out, or at least a couple more votes out, but it was hard for me to fathom that if the merge happened during the time it normally happens over the last few, years, that I wouldn't be able to make the merge. You know, there was always kind of in the back of my mind this concern that, like, I always knew that Wendell, Nick, and Michelle were friends. And obviously, Wendell and Michelle had that relationship. And I'd wondered whether the fact that, like, we had even gotten connected was part of this elaborate orchestrated thing, even before the game, to kind of pull me in and kind of give me the sense that, like, you know, I'm part of a core alliance, when in reality that they had their own kind of party. I realize now that I don't think that was the case. I think they genuinely wanted the four of us to go to the end together. And because we lost that last challenge by like a split second and we had to pick somebody, I think I was basically just the person that they knew the least for the least amount of time. So, and I don't know what I could have done differently in that circumstance. But yeah, I really did think, and at least I hoped, that if you're just looking at things from a strategic standpoint, it would have been obvious that voting me out would not have served anyone's interest. To me, it seemed pretty clear, and again, I thought this was just everyone felt the same way about this, that Wendell and Michelle would not be a sustainable pairing. Everyone knew that they had dated before, and then everyone suspected that they would try to align, right?
Yeah.
They tricked it. And so in any combination where you go forward with, you know, an alliance that includes Wendell and Michelle, it was not going to lead to good things, because at one point, one of them would get voted out, and then whoever was left would lose control of the game. So, you know, in my mind, the obviously kind of clear thing to do, again, even if you're looking from the perspective of either Michelle or Nick, I think, you know, either of them could have gone, if it was like me, Wendell, and Michelle, I think things would have been fine. I think if it was like Wendell, me, and Nick, I think things would have been fine. I think if it was, you know, Nick, Wendell, Mick, Michelle, me, I think things would have been fine. Because I had a lot of good relationships with the other folks, I think if we'd gone into the merge, then you would have had a dominant alliance of, say Wendell had gone home, as I thought he was going to go home. It would have been me, Nick, Sophie, Tony, Sarah, again, who also I had alliances with, Kim, and then Michelle. And that would have given you a dominant alliance, and we basically would have controlled the game. It would have turned out completely differently. But what ended up happening was, I think Michelle, you know, again, she had a relationship with Wendell. And then Nick, I was surprised too, because to me, it seemed obvious that if he stuck with us as that group, we would have controlled the game going into the merge. And, you know, one thing you learn from Survivor over and over again is you want to go into the merge with the numbers. That's critically important. So I can't fault Michelle, because at the end of the day, she got to the end. So kudos to her. Like, you know,
no I fault to Michelle.
Yeah, you can't like say, oh, you made a mistake if you got all the way to the end. So again, but I think it would have been a very different path for her. I think what could have happened was she would have been part of the dominant alliance where we were essentially controlling the shots. Even if I thought, and I thought at some point maybe Nick and Michelle would try to backstab me, I thought it would I thought the obvious thing would be like you do it after the merge. Like you get into merge, you control the vote, and then at some point, then you try to get out the person that you think you don't want to go against with in the end. But I think they pulled the trigger too early. And I think in Nick's case, the same thing happened where, again, he went with a pairing that was not going to sustain over time. And that's exactly what happened. As soon as it got to the merge, Wendell got targeted, and then they basically lost control of the game. So, I mean, Nick has said the same thing to me, that in retrospect, he wishes things had gone differently and he'd chosen differently.
Because Wendell is going to go out next anyway. But so I guess my bigger question, though, is for you of was the idea to vote out Michelle? It seems like that Michelle's name never came up. And I know that you have a relationship with her and Nick has a relationship with her. And certainly Wendell has a past relationship with her.
Yeah.
But if the three of you stick together, isn't that the best look optically?
Which
coming?
Three?
The three guys, the three original DeKal members. Then you come back into the merge and say, hey, DeKal, let's put this all back together, as opposed to, because even if you because you cast your vote for Wendell, when you come back, won't there be questions for you also, like, hey, why vote out Wendell? Isn't he with us? Isn't he one of the DeKal tribe?
I think obviously I had had something planned for that. I think by that point in time there was enough concern about Wendell kind of going off on a limb, especially in the tribal council. And they didn't show all the tribal councils, but there was quite a bit of stuff that came out that he would say that for everyone else in the alliance, they were like, that seemed unnecessary. It introduced a randomness that didn't need to be there. And so I think I would have been able to just explain, hey, listen, like, you know, we had this vote with Parvati and all this stuff came out. He basically told Parvati that, you know, if she offered him the fire tokens, he would change the vote. Like, so at that point, it became fairly clear he had to go. Like, he was potentially a loose cannon who was going to turn against the alliance. I think that would have been something I could have pulled off, and I think people would have believed, because they'd seen enough of that in prior tribal councils. I mean, this is something we had all talked about in prior tribal councils, where like, wait, what's going on with Wendell? Why did he say that? So, yeah. Again, I don't know. Maybe the same thing could have happened, but I don't think they could have said the same thing about me, which is why I also didn't think they would try to vote me out, because what would be the excuse there? Like, what would they say? And I think that's what ended up obviously happening, which is people are like, well, what happened if you turned against you without any good reason?
Do you think if you would have lobbied to get Michelle out at that vote that you could have gotten through that tribal council with Nick and Wendell? Or had there been too much friction between you and Wendell at that point because of everything that had gone on with the Parvati?
There wasn't friction, actually. I mean, I was pretty forthright. I mean, my general approach in Survivor is to try to be as honest as I can. I mean, obviously, you have to lie, especially in this like kind of new generation where it's possible for anyone to have an hidden idol. And so you have to lie to make them feel like they're not going to get voted out, so they won't play it. With the introduction of fire tokens, it also adds more reasons to lie, because you always want to try to orchestrate the vote such that you can get the person's fire tokens by convincing them that it wasn't a unanimous vote. So, you know, but for the most part, like, I try not to, right? And when I can, I try to give honest advice. And so after the Parvati thing, I was pretty upset at Wendell. I was pretty upset at him. But, you know, we talked it out. Like, I told him, like, hey, listen, like, you know, what you said really created a lot of uncertainty and made us really nervous. You know, we also thought it was kind of like unnecessary, you know, like if we knew she was going home, like why raise all this stuff? We actually had a good conversation about it. So Wendell and I were on pretty good terms. Like, we've never had any kind of angst between us. And, you know, and certainly afterwards, like we consider him to be one of the people I really have a great relationship with, you know, coming on the game. And yeah, so anyway, to your question, do I think if we had tried to vote up Michelle, that could have happened? I don't know. Possibly, but you know, at the end of the day, I still think that the fact that the three of them knew each other and had known each other for a much longer period of time than I did probably would have trumped. You know?
So if you
did, I think for Nick, go ahead.
I was going to just ask you that, you know, had you gotten to the merge, let's say hypothetically, okay, they went along with it. They voted out Wendell at that spot. Wendell's not there to get voted out the first vote of the merge. How do you think that the rest of the game shakes out if you were there at the merge?
Yeah, again, I think it would have turned out very, very differently. I think we would have had a very strong alliance among, because, you know, one of the great things that we were able to do and that I tried really hard to work at was when DeKal was still a tribe, tried to align the votes in such a way that it wasn't clear which coalitions were the strongest and where people fell within their hierarchy of alliances. And so I think going into the merge, I would have hopefully been able to reconnect with Sophie. Sandra and I were tight. Sarah and I were tight because, again, the whole thing about, you know, Jonathan Penner, Tony and I also had an alliance.
Yes.
Michelle obviously would have been part of it. And then Adam, I think I would have been able to, I mean, Adam, I probably would have been able to work with, because he and I also kind of knew each other from before. Not very well, but, you know, he went to the same college I did. And he had reached out a while ago. And so, yeah, I mean, it would have been a completely different set of alliances that would have gotten through. I think what potentially would have happened was people on the old Selly tribe may have gotten decimated. And at some point we would have turned on each other, but the alliances, I think, would have been potentially different. So just a very, very different competition. So this thing that you saw between the strongest alliance that got to the end between Ben and Denise and Tony and Sarah, I don't think that would have happened. Like, you know, that only came up in the aftermath of everything that happened otherwise. So it just would have been a very, very different game.
Let me ask you a little bit about the Edge of Extinction. You were a participant in the first Edge of Extinction challenge, and you did not have the opportunity to get any advantages for the first Edge of Extinction challenge. A lot of people talked about this at the time. This was not unfair, or this was not fair the way that it was done. Were you at the time feeling like, hey, this isn't right? Well, I just got here. How come I didn't get any advantages?
Totally. Yeah. I felt like it got screwed. You know, again, I'm not saying it's unfair. I mean, Survivor's a game. We all know what we signed up for. And I don't want to harbor any kind of bitterness. I'm not mad. Like everyone from the game, I've told them, you know, I've made up with. But yeah, at the time I was pretty upset. I was like, man, okay, we lost that last challenge by a split second. The merge didn't happen when I thought it was going to happen. And that kind of completely blew up my game. Right. And then I get sent to Extinction Island, and then it turns out that if you have fire tokens, you can buy advantage on the Battleback Challenge. And I have no opportunity to get a token, like to earn any fire tokens. Like, I'm totally screwed. So in that Battleback Challenge, I mean, you know, who knows? But I think if I had been on an even playing field, I think I had a really good shot at winning. Like,
we were close.
I was right there. Yeah. And the thing that that first advantage got you was the being able to avoid digging that hole. That hole took me like forever. Like I can't, man, I felt like I was just in like Groundhog Day. Like I would just dig and dig and dig. And, you know, they kept assuring me like, no, the thing is actually centered. I'm like, I'm telling you, it's not here. I'm like digging straight down. So that took, I don't know how long. I mean, I'm sure it was less time than it felt like, but it felt like it was forever. And Parvati, I think, had the same thing too. She was digging forever.
Yes.
So yeah, I really think if I had gotten there sooner, I think I would have probably been able to come back because it was really close regardless. And then again, that would have ended up being a very, very different game.
And you're allowed to complain.
Yeah, so that was a bummer for me.
You're allowed to say that it wasn't fair, that if our friend Jonathan Penner was here, he might say, that was bollocks and you know it.
That's good.
My ass. So you could give it back to Jeff and say it wasn't fair. That's fine.
Yeah. I mean, I have lots of thoughts about the Edge in general and the fire tokens. I don't know if I share this. I'm not a fan of Edge of Extinction. Yeah. If I'd known that it was going to be in play, I would not have come back for sure.
You were very outspoken about it, even as from what was reported back at the first tribal council that you guys went to.
Yeah. And the fire tokens too, I feel like, I think they're a really interesting innovation. I like them in concept.
They added a new layer of duplicity to the game.
They expand the range of options that are available to you because you can kind of use them to align incentives in such a way to make things possible that otherwise would have happened. But I just kind of think like if you're going to introduce something so new, like you kind of want to get the kinks out. So rather than introduce it in an all winter season, then it would have been better to try it beforehand to see what's working, what's not working. The problem I have with the fire tokens is that from the implementation standpoint, no one really understood how they were going to be used, right? So like to make a game interesting and intelligible, everyone has to know what the rules are. Yes. That way that you can at least plan for things. You can scheme around it. Like if you know that like if you get sent to extinction, someone's going to get clues and they might come back with an island, you can hedge against it. You can come up with strategies to counteract it. The fire tokens were just introduced in a way that people had no idea how to... the way that the analogy I use is like, it's like, say there was a cloak of invisibility that was going to be on Survivor, and no one really knew how it was going to be found or how it was going to work, and someone just randomly kind of found it. then the person goes off and does all sorts of interesting things. And it's not really that interesting because you don't know about it. If someone's like sitting there spying.
Well, in a way, yeah. Isn't that what Tony did?
Yeah. That's kind of what Tony did. But again, it's conceivable within the bounds of physics that someone could be hiding.
Nobody conceived a spy nest before Tony.
That's true.
Yeah.
Tony's a special.
But do you have a thought on, can you fix the fire tokens or improve them? That we just did a podcast this week that we called The State of Survivor, Season 41 and Beyond. And we talked about the fire tokens and some of the things that they could be used for. And everybody on the panel thought that, you should not have the fire tokens in the game and then have no sort of like big payoff. I think a lot of people thought that there would be some great advantage at the end of the game for whoever had the most fire tokens. It really didn't matter. They were really only valuable for the person on the edge. So the fire tokens will be back, according to Jeff, in future seasons of Survivor. How should they be using the fire tokens?
I think the thing is not so much, at least from my perspective, like how do you change how they're used? It's just more having an equitable distribution of the information about how they're used. Like no one had any idea that people would be sending fire tokens from the edge. No one had any idea that if you're paying for the fire tokens, it would be benefiting someone from the edge who could potentially come back later on.
Yeah.
Like if those are all mechanics of the game that people understood, then you could make an informed decision and say like, oh, if I get this advantage, I don't know. I don't want to give it to this person because that person might come back. You know, you can think about it and kind of hedge around it. So for me, I don't have any, kind of silver bullet for how to make the fire tokens better. The only thing I just think is that you have to explain the rules of how these are used and how to potentially impact the game. Because then you can have like some pretty interesting like strategies around it. In the absence of that, it just adds a layer of randomness that just kind of makes the game kind of random.
Not great. We don't like randomness. Yul, you got a lot of compliments on...
Can I mention one other thing?
Yes.
Sorry. Before I visit, on the merge thing, I don't know if this is true. Again, I thought the merge was going to happen at a certain point in time just based on historical precedent. I don't know if this has played any role in it, but I suspect that it could have played a role. The fact that Sandra quit.
Oh.
Like, I wonder if that might have actually caused the merge to happen one round later than it otherwise would have. Because if she hadn't quit, what would have happened was you'd have 12 people in the game and 8 people on the edge for the battle back challenge. And, just based on historical precedent, one person makes it back and then you have the merge among 13 people. Sandra quitting right before the battle back challenge effectively basically meant that you had 12 people in the game and 7 for the battle back challenge. And I wonder if the producers felt like, 7's not enough. We need to have one more. And I think there could be different reasons for that. You might just think it's more interesting that way. But the other thing could be a practical thing, which is these elaborate obstacles are set up in advance and it's hard to change it last minute. So if you set it up for 8 people and just like a few days before someone quits and you don't have 8 people, it's going to be hard to change things around. So I also wonder if the fact that Sandra quit also
I don't know.
So many what ifs. All right, sorry.
But what I wanted to ask you about was that, so many people commented on, despite the time off in between your seasons, that you were in great shape in Survivor Cook Islands and you came back and you were in great shape again. Can I ask you, what do you do to stay in good shape as all these years have gone by?
Thank you. I appreciate that. I was not in great shape when it got asked. I figured, if I'm going to do this, I need to get back in shape. I tried to be more thoughtful about the way I did it than the last time I did it, which was just go to the gym and lift a bunch of weights, which actually I don't think is like the right way to do it. I think Survivor challenges are much more about coordination, balance, full body movement type stuff. So I got a personal trainer. I worked out with him really hard. I ate well and I was able to get back in decent shape and I don't know how much time did we have, maybe in like 6 weeks or so. So it wasn't like I stayed in great shape. Like again, kids, work, you kind of let yourself go. I had a dad bod, but I've always been fortunate that if I just work really hard at it and disciplined that I can kind of put myself back in shape fairly quickly. To be honest, I think most people can. It's just a matter of just, being disciplined about it.
What is it that you do? You didn't lift weights. Is there like a specific program that you do?
You mean for the show or just in general?
In general.
In general, I haven't worked out in like 3 months or so.
You've been busy. I've
been busy. When I can, I try to go running. I try to do kind of body weight things like pull-ups and push-ups and, you know, just very basic things. And I find that if you just do it enough times and you're somewhat consistent about it, you can stay in reasonably good shape. I don't have any secret to diet. Like, I just try to eat in moderation. You don't go crazy. You try to watch how many carbs you eat and kind of amount of, you know, so it's, I've generally found that in life, the key to a lot of things is just moderation.
Moderation.
Like, they say that like drinking is okay as long as you do it in moderation. So as long as you don't go crazy and kind of watch yourself, I think, you know, it hasn't been too hard to stay.
Will you have a drink or two?
I actually can't. I have this weird genetic thing where if I drink alcohol, my body can't metabolize it. And it basically causes me to have this blinding headache. Like, it feels like someone's hitting my head with a sledgehammer.
Okay. Well, that, maybe that's one of the reasons you're so productive.
Maybe, maybe. I'm sure it's probably kept me out of trouble.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. But I can't drink, unfortunately. I wish I could.
Yeah. I'm really not much of a drinker, myself right now at this point in my life. I just find that it's just, too much, pain the next day.
Yeah. I don't know. Once you have kind of kids, you realize you can't really catch up on sleep on the weekends because your kids are natural alarm clocks and they will wake up at the same time no matter what you do.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, let me just ask you a little bit about your time on the edge, because I know you said you don't like it. It was unpleasant, the edge, correct?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. It was very unpleasant.
Yeah. Now, is that the conditions or sort of like the social politics of the Edge of Extinction? Or both?
Definitely both. I think it's both. Like, you know, it's just a crappy place to be. Like, you're not getting much food. There's not much shelter. So physically it's hard, but the social dynamics are also really tough. I mean, you're taking people who are feeling bitter, unhappy. They didn't get farther in the game. They felt like they should have. You're also mixing that with physical deprivation. It just creates this toxic stew of bringing out the worst in people, I would say.
Yeah. One of the things that got mentioned a little bit, and I believe this was on the show, or like, I think it came up right after the show, was that you and Natalie had gotten into an argument, and people had did not like how that had gone.
It's just an argument. It was more one sided. Yes. I was kind of getting wailed on.
Can you explain what happened a little bit?
I wasn't really fighting with her.
Yes.
Kind of like pounding on me. Yeah. Sorry. Go ahead.
Yeah, so something had happened, but I don't think that we really understand. Like, a couple of people have commented on that there was some sort of a disagreement between you and Natalie, and then a lot of people, cited that as maybe a reason why they didn't want to vote for Natalie, or a reason why they didn't feel as good about Natalie after that.
Yeah, it was. You know, I would say it was more symptomatic of kind of underlying things, but when I got to the edge, I did not feel kind of very welcome. Mm-hmm. There was clearly a group of people who knew each other and, you know, and were friends. And again, there are, I think, legitimate reasons too. I think people felt like I had played a role in kind of ousting them, and given the fact that there had been like pregame alliances and things like that, that might have played a factor. Mm-hmm. But I think, I don't know why, I felt like a lot of it was directed at me in particular. Maybe it was just because I was maybe the first person that people kind of heard this about. I'm not quite sure. Anyway, the thing with Natalie was, I just felt like I could do no right by her. Like, whatever I tried, like whether it was fishing or whatever, trying to get, like, it just felt like in one way or another, it was all kind of portrayed in a negative way. The thing that precipitated that argument was, Adam had just gotten voted off, and you know, there was a lot of antipathy towards Adam. You know, again, I wasn't on the other tribe, but there was just a lot of negative things said about him. And the group, not everyone, but kind of the dominant coalition basically decided that they were not going to be very nice to him, right? Not going to tell him where to find food on the island. They're going to withhold stuff, all sorts of whatever. So anyway, you know, when Anna came out, I don't know. I just felt like that seemed inappropriate. Mm-hmm. Like, you know, and stuff like this would happen. And, you know, my general sense is like, look, I mean, you know, I wish I got farther too, but there's no reason to like be unnecessarily harsh to people, right? unless it clearly serves some sort of strategic value in the game, that then you can understand it. But if it was just sort of like venting or whatever, that seemed like something that I wasn't super comfortable with. So anyway, when Adam came out, I kind of gave him a heads up. I said, hey, listen, like a lot of people are pretty upset at you. And so I kind of showed him how things worked. And then I offered to go get rice with him. So we went up to go get rice and, you know, obviously he was feeling pretty down. And so we ended up having like a long conversation about just life in general. And we ended up taking much longer than we should have. Like I should have in my own head been like, oh, like these people are waiting for us to come back.
Yeah.
You know, but just, we were just having a very honest conversation. And obviously he was going through a hard time as well. So by the time we got back, it went bonkers.
But it was hey, Natalie, where's the rice, guys? We've been waiting. The water is boiling.
Exactly.
Boy. Yeah. And yeah, Adam can't stay out of everybody getting mad at him for going off and taking too long.
Yeah, that seems to be a recurring thing. Yeah, anyway, I mean, that just kind of led to a very large kind of argument that was kind of one-sided.
Yeah.
I think other people saw that and felt like maybe that was maybe excessive. Mm-hmm. And certainly in my case, it influenced my own decision. I mean, it wasn't like a personal thing. Like in terms of how I voted, I voted for Tony. I thought he deserved to win.
Yeah.
But I think for Natalie, again, I think she played an incredibly strong game. Like given the card she was dealt with, like, man, she just completely dominated on the edge
for 20 some odd days at that point. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. And she really just like controlled the flow of, kind of advantages back into the game. But for me, taking aside my own personal feelings as to how she handled the situation, from a pure strategic standpoint, I thought it was a mistake, right? Mm-hmm. Like, if there's nothing else that you can do on edge of extinction, the biggest advantage strategically have is this opportunity to build relationships with everyone there.
Sure.
And, you know, whether it was me or other people, if she didn't use that time to build those relationships, that just seemed like a major strategic oversight. So I think for me, certainly that was kind of a factor in terms of who I thought played the best overall game.
Yeah.
Apart from any personal feelings I might have had related to this.
Yule, did you have any positive times on the Edge of Extinction? Were there any good days?
It was a rough time. You know, it felt like, I don't know, personally, I honestly felt like I was kind of back in school when I was, you know, bullied.
Well, I would think it would be very frustrating because you're somebody who is, you know, extremely accomplished in your real life, in your professional life. And you have to feel like, I would think like if I was you and I was out there, I'd be like, look, I wanted to come back for this and I wanted to do the right thing and do something for Jonathan and Stacy. And I came back and I did this and my wife said, I shouldn't do it, but I said I wanted to. And now I'm here and I agreed to go do it, but now this is isn't enough enough. Like I don't want to quit, I don't want to walk out of here, but you know, I've got things to do.
Yeah, the thing that kind of bummed me out, I tried to keep things in perspective and not let it get to me too much. It did make me feel again like, you know, a lot of my life I kind of grew up feeling marginalized, just, you know, and it kind of brought back a lot of those memories. I didn't want to leave feeling bitter towards anybody, so I don't harbor any ill will towards anyone. I've tried to maintain good relationships, and anyone who's ever reached out since the show asked for any help, I've tried to give, including to Natalie, actually. At one point she reached out asking for help and advice, and I tried to give as much as I could. No ill will.
Yeah.
It was kind of a bummer. I think partly what happened was, you know, once I got voted out, I realized my chances of winning the game at this point are like negligible. I mean, there's like some microscopic chance. I would still try, but at that point, I wasn't really playing the game as much anymore. I was thinking like, I have this amount of time. I'm stuck on this island. What's the best I could make out of this experience? And in my normal life, like, you know, just there's so many, you know, just so many things going on, like with work, with kids, family. You don't really have an opportunity to just get to know people, get to know new people, and really kind of like spend time with them. And I was thinking the one thing we have here is lots of time. Like there's no other distraction except the occasional kind of challenge. And so I really, for my part, kind of shifted into this mode of like, you know, I really want to use this opportunity to get to know people. Like this is an incredibly interesting collection of people from all different walks of life. They're all accomplished in their own way. And it just seemed like a great opportunity to just get to know them. And if I can come out of this experience, obviously it didn't work out the way I wanted to, but if I can come out of this with some good friendships and relationships and different perspective than it, I felt like it would have been a good experience. So that was a mentality I had. But I think people just assumed that I was playing the game and that I was still, you know, trying to act a certain way to try to be nice so that people would try to vote for me. And, you know, it's not to say that that wasn't lost on me. Obviously, if there was some chance I got back, I would want to have a good relationship. But so I wasn't really at that point.
Yeah.
So I will say that I do feel like I have come out of the experience with some of those types of relationships. You know, the person that I felt like I, you know, really, I mean, there are a number of people on the edge that I felt like I became much closer to. Obviously, Wendell, Danny and I got to build a really strong relationship. You know, Adam and I obviously became friends. Ethan is probably the person that I feel like I built the strongest relationship with.
Yeah.
He and I've always respected him as a great person and a great winner. He was, for me, the role model for the kind of winner that I wanted to be, which is to use this platform for something that's like, you know, meaningful and bigger than yourself. And so he and I really bonded, and he's probably the person that I keep in the closest contact with since the show. I also built a really good relationship with like Boston Rob and to some extent Amber. Like Rob is someone who I really looked up to. You know, he's interesting. He's like in real life, he has this like magnetic charisma. He kind of is like this godfather in real life. And when things felt like they were getting excessive in terms of just people, you know, getting down on me, like he would intervene. He would say, hey, just knock it off. You know? So I was grateful for that. And he and I have stayed in contact. So I do feel like I am coming away from this experience with a lot of really, you know, the screensaver is killing me. I got to come up with an easier password because I can't get it right. but yeah, I will say I will not.
Breadfruit is hard to spell. On, yes.
Yes, exactly. That's just actually the Yule is pretty. That's easy.
Yeah. But 10 times.
Yeah. So anyway, that, you know, I probably won't go into too much more than that because you know, one thing I do want is have just like water under the bridge. And I've come to peace with things. But yeah, it was not the thing that if I have time again, I'd look fondly back as like one of my happiest memories.
You said that you probably would never do the Survivor again. Would you say that you would definitely never do Survivor again?
You know, I think I would do it if they had like an all charity version of it. Like that would be worthwhile.
So like
if
they were like, whoever won, everybody's playing for a charity and then the winner would be, you know,
you have to pick your charity.
Okay.
Or there's a pre-designated charity or something like that. I mean, you're just playing for the game. Like I think it's hard for me to, it's unlikely I would come back otherwise.
Can I ask you one question on the all charity version? Do you think that that would affect the way that people played? Where if people were playing for a cause as opposed to playing for personal gain, do you think that the behavior of the players would be different?
I actually think it could be more interesting. Mm-hmm. Like in my case, the fact that I was playing, because you know my plan was if I won, I was just going to donate the money. So it made me feel less constrained. Like I felt more okay just lying and like playing really hard and pre-gaming and all that kind of stuff. Cause normally like if I was playing for myself, I felt like, or like, you know, when I played Cook Islands, it was like also kind of representing my community. I felt more constrained. Yeah. You know, I couldn't really do nasty things cause like, I don't want that to reflect on you. Know, but it's like, if you know that, like there's no question of what your ultimate motives are and you're doing for something other than yourself and big for you, then you can really just kind of like go, you know, pedal to the metal.
My thinking was that, you know, somebody might be like, oh, like, hey, I got to like, how am I going to pay off my mortgage? I'm going to be super desperate and I'll lie. I'll do anything. But maybe you're saying that people can play more aggressively because they're like, hey, it's not my money.
I think it could go both ways. Like in some cases, I think if people are in like dire financial straits, obviously like behind the motive. But in some cases, I actually think
scared,
like
though.
In Ethan, for example.
Scared money doesn't
they play
make
scared,
money.
Yeah, exactly. In this case, you're just like, look, I'm just going to go take big risks because what I got to lose, like it's all going to go to a good cause. So I actually think it would be kind of interesting to do it that way.
Yeah.
Other than that, I think it'd be hard for me to come back because I think people would know that my plan would be to donate the money and like no one would ever want to take me to the final. So they'd be like, get this guy out.
Wow.
Like,
but think of the goodwill for CBS that they could do where, you know, maybe they give like $50,000 to everybody's charity who shows up and then...
Totally.
Yeah.
I would love for them to do that. I think it would be super interesting. And I bet you could just get a lot of really interesting people to do that too.
Yeah.
I wonder if you could just get a bunch of celebrities who'd be willing to donate to a cause and you can have a really interesting show. I don't know.
Yeah. Yul, can I ask you about life post-Survivor? Do you have any big goals or things that you're hoping to accomplish post-Survivor 40?
You mean in the context of Survivor?
No,
or just
in the context of Yul Kwan.
Yeah, sure what I'm working on right now. And this is partly the reason why I've completely just dropped off the face of the planet. So I work at Google, and one of the projects I'm helping to lead is this effort to build technologies that help with contact tracing to help contain the spread of COVID-19. It's basically trying to help the world get back to normal and help build tools that are going to help governments and health authorities be able to come out of lockdown. So it started kind of in the middle of the season, and it's been this crazy sprint. Like I've literally been working every single day, including nights, weekends, holidays. This is the first time I'm getting any time off. So I feel kind of badly because I know that I just sort of completely,
hey,
I was active on social media.
Yul,
I was active on Reddit.
Don't apologize for working on trying to fix the coronavirus. Okay. That you do not need to apologize for that. Please, that I feel bad that I'm taking time away from you working on this.
No, this has been a lot of fun. I appreciate this opportunity to like just talk to my fans because I do feel like I left everyone hanging. I was like very active, especially for the ALS campaign, you know, like, and we did a tremendous amount of good, but I feel like I just haven't had the ability to properly like get closure on that to thank people. And so I'm glad I had this opportunity.
Yeah.
I don't want people to get the wrong impression. It's not like I don't care. And I still plan on doing an MA on Reddit, all that kind of stuff. Just absolutely bonkers trying to help with this effort.
Yeah. And the fact that, you know, you're working on this project and working on trying to, you know, help people and save lives with, trying to, work on the contact tracing with the coronavirus, with, you know, everything that you've done to help people in the past. I just think it speaks, so much to who you are as a person, Yul. And, it is a great pleasure to, you know, get to have you as part of this, you know, crazy, extended family of Survivor people that I get to talk to.
Well, thank you, Rob. And I also want to just thank you for one, having me on the show, but I know that you've also been like very supportive of the Penners, like Stacey Tuttle and Jonathan.
Yes. I love them too, Yul. That Jonathan Penner has been, a good friend, and, you know, I've gotten to spend time with them, and, gone and done podcasts at their house. And, I've gotten to know, you know, Jonathan and Stacey well over the years. And, it's such a terrible thing that's happened to that, you know, wonderful family, and you know, I've been very moved to see everything that you've done for them.
Well, thank you, and just so that everyone knows, this I want to call this out. Like, you also made a generous donation to the campaign early on, and so again, just really want to thank you for that, Rob.
I appreciate that.
So thank you.
Yeah, Yul. I know you're so busy. Is there anything that you want people to go and look? Obviously, the ALS link. Let's hear that one more time.
Yeah, so you can go to cbs.com/survivoralsinfo. Hopefully you can kind of pop that up somewhere. We're still collecting donations. Yeah, and we've raised a good amount of money, $250,000 for, you know, a lot of different charities. So... Mm-hmm. I wish we could have, obviously I regret not winning. But I wish we had the live finale. That was kind of a bummer. Yeah. Like I really thought, you know, the plan was to have Jonathan and Stacey on there. I think if they had been on there, it would have been another opportunity to raise more money. I had asked CBS if they would consider matching the donations that we had raised, or at least making just kind of a donation. And it didn't really pan out. I was also hoping maybe like Sia would be able to watch and kind of like, you know, make a contribution to support them and ALS victims. But you know, unfortunately, all that stuff didn't happen. But regardless, I do want to just thank everyone who's been so kind and supportive on Reddit, on social media, on the show. Like, it's been really incredible. And Jonathan, Stacey, and I can't thank you enough. So really appreciate that.
Cool. On a less serious note, what do you do in your spare time? I know you work incredibly hard, but if hypothetically, if there wasn't a quarantine and a lockdown, like what do you do for fun?
You know, the thing I've always wanted to do, besides just spending more time with my kids, which I feel like because always been an issue. One of the reasons I was thinking is if I went on Survivor, and even if I got booted out early, at least I could use that time to just read. I could sit on Ponderosa and have like, I don't know, like a stack of like 30 books over the last 10 or 20 years I've been meaning to read. I just haven't had the time to do that. I would love to just kind of read all the different things that I've been meaning to do, and I haven't had a chance.
What do you read? Fiction, nonfiction?
Everything. Like, you know, I love science fiction, fantasy, and there have been so many great novels I've
add one thing to that? You know, I did an interview with Ozzy this year. For years I've wanted to interview Ozzy, and I thought I had a really great interview with Ozzy a couple of months ago. And Ozzy talked about how he wanted to start a science fiction book club.
Oh, interesting. Really?
Yeah, he loves science fiction books. This could be, you guys could reconnect over trading sci-fi book recommendations back and forth.
Yeah, I'd be down for it.
Years later that you and Ozzy just go back and forth trading book recommendations?
Yeah, that'd be kind of wild. That'd be kind of funny. I think I'd rather.
I swear to God, he loves science fiction books.
Yeah. What is he up to nowadays?
I don't remember, you know, specifically, what he was working on, occupationally, but it was a great interview.
Maybe we could read science fiction books to each other sitting in a hot tub.
Maybe.
That would be one hell of a reunion.
Parvati, I know she wrote a children's book. I don't know if she does sci-fi books.
She did. She wrote this delightful children's book, and she sent me copies to both my girls. So I was very thankful for that. It was a very, very kind gesture of her.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
So probably no more hot tub in her future.
Probably not. Probably not. Your wife would be less of a fan of Parvati after that.
Actually, it's funny. My wife was a big fan of Parvati. Yeah.
Name is Sophie, right?
Sophie, yeah. Yes. She was a big fan of Parvati.
So you read sci-fi books and anything else that you want to read?
Sci-fi, fantasy, just a bunch of other kind of great books that have come out over time. A bunch of stuff by Steven Pinker. I just feel like there's so much. I mean, I think it's one of the consequences of one, you know, being busy, but two, living in a world that's dominated by like social media where you don't really read stuff anymore. Like there's this automatic assumption that if something is older than like a day or a week, it's not timely anymore. Yes. And I feel like I've fallen into that. And so my ability to read kind of long form works of fiction or nonfiction, it just really, I can't even tell you the last time I read a real book.
Yeah. I've
become functionally illiterate.
No, I don't believe that. I'm much more into nonfiction. I especially love anything that's like self-development, but I do audiobooks. Do you have any recommendations on anything that's like a nonfiction self-development or business book that people should check out?
Oh, gosh. I have like a list of stuff. It's not a self-development book, but the thing that I would really, there are two things that I'd highly recommend both as audiobooks. One is Cultures of the World. You can get it on Audible. It's basically a lecture series where this professor talks about all the different cultures and breaks them down along a number of different dimensions. And then he takes all the major cultural groupings around the world and, you know, discusses like how, you know, the underpinnings of why they are the way they are. It's absolutely fascinating and gave me a lot of insight into other people's cultures and other people who come from these cultures that I never quite understood why. And I'm like, oh my God, I totally get it. So that's something I highly recommend. I think that's a great, great thing to listen to. The other one is Steven Pinker's I think it's Better Angels of Our Nature. The basic thesis here is, you know, we live in a world where you just feel like the world is going to hell in a handbasket. Things are getting worse. There's more violence, there's more chaos, all that kind of stuff. But if you step back and you look at the arc of human development and human history, you realize that the rates of violence have gone down dramatically over time, even during the 20th century, which had the two great world wars, where people just seemed like it was more violent than any other century in the world. It's absolutely not true. From a statistical standpoint, the chances of you dying a violent death are infinitesimally small compared to what it was just like even like a few generations ago. It's kind of hard to listen to a read because some of it's just like, ugh, it's like a gut punch. You're like, oh man, people have done some really crappy things to each other over time. But it does give you the sense of like, wow, if you step back and see how the world has actually evolved and the progress we've made, it makes you much more optimistic. So I would recommend that as a really good read too.
Okay. Well, that I like ending on a optimistic and hopeful point because sometimes, especially right now, it seems like that the world is spinning out of control. So that gives me encouragement to hear that you, and I value your opinion on smart things. That I say, okay, all right. If Yule feels like you know, we're making progress, then all right, I'll go with that. I'll sleep better tonight.
Well, I hope you do. And again, I you know, it does feel like we're in an unprecedented period of time. But I mean, fundamentally, I still remain optimistic. You know, yeah. I do think the world is over time getting to a better place, and there are definitely a lot of challenges we have to deal with. I mean, I still worry about how like the level of inequality in this world, right? It does feel like the concentration of wealth and it's gotten to be a challenge. I worry that our kind of longer term political institutions have really kind of eroded over time. But I still think fundamentally optimistically. I think if you kind of step back and, you know, there's this kind of cognitive bias where you tend to just focus on the things that you see all the time. There's something about like bad news that tends to become more viral and kind of drives the news cycle. But it overlooks a lot of the incremental progress that actually over time tends to be more meaningful and sustainable. And, you know, hope we don't lose sight of that.
Okay. Yul Kwon, anything else you want to tell the listeners?
The other regret that I have from Survivor is something they didn't show, because there's a lot of really good stuff they didn't show this season. I think it's another reason why I wasn't a fan of The Edge, because it just took up so much time that you missed a lot of like really good stuff, a lot of good footage. Some of the stuff they showed in the kind of like videos online, but you missed a lot of the strategy. I mean, there was a ton of strategy.
Yeah.
But there's one thing that I was really looking forward to, and I wanted to watch with my kids, but they didn't show. So I can't remember if it was my last tribal council or the one before. But at one point, the first time I played on Cook Islands, Probst always got on my case. Like, he was always like mad at me because I didn't say stuff at Tribal Council. Like, for me, I figured like, why would I say anything at Tribal Council? It's just like going to bite me in the butt. I tried to be very PC and it drove him nuts because I didn't say anything that he considered to be interesting. So this time around, I'm just like, all right, I'm going to say a lot more stuff. And, I think he liked it. I spoke my mind a lot more, kind of breakdowns of what was actually happening. And I remember at one point, I gave this long sort of digression about, I can't remember what it was about, either what how fire tokens were working or maybe how survivors changed over time. And he was like, whoa, that's pretty good. You should do my job. In fact, why don't we switch? I'm like, what do you mean? He's like, yeah, let's switch seats. I'm like, what? You're kidding me. So he got out of his seat and he took my seat and I took his seat. And I was just like,
what am I doing? Which tribal council was this?
It was either the one that I actually got blindsided or the one before.
You get voted out. It's like, oh, I guess you know everything. Oh, yeah, why don't you see my seat? Why'd you take over? And then you get voted out. Boy, what an episode that would have been.
Yeah. I think it must have been maybe the one before that.
Was he setting you up? Did you think he knew that you were getting blindsided and then wanted?
No.
Yeah.
I don't think so. I don't think it was the episode where I got blindsided. I think it was probably the one beforehand. Mm-hmm. But it was just such a funny moment.
Yeah,
you know? And I remember thinking in my head, oh my God, like, here's my chance. I could be Jeff Probst. And I just had like total stage fright. I'm like, I'm sorry.
I know you have done hosting before in your past. That was something that we talked about the last time that we got to do a podcast interview.
The PBS thing.
Yes. Is that something that you would be interested in?
I... I will say, so for context, so it was like in 2009, I ended up posting this mini series on PBS called America Revealed, which was really about technology. Like, what are the main kind of systems and networks that make America work? That was so much fun. I had so much fun doing that. We filmed for basically 2 years. I went around the country interviewing all these really interesting people, talking about how like technology works and all that kind of stuff. That was probably the one of the most fun things I've ever done, because it was sort of this mix of like entertainment. So you got to do all kinds of crazy stuff, like I jump out of plane, stuff like that. But it was like really substantive stuff that was actually like really interesting. So something like that, I think, would be a ton of fun. I don't know if I would. I mean, I wouldn't pursue hosting as like a career or anything like that. One, I don't think I have the talent. Like Jeff Probst is just like these leagues. But it's also, you know, but the nature of entertainment is that it tends to be very fickle, right? Like there's not a lot of longevity. And so I would do it for fun. So if there was another opportunity to host something like that, I think that'd be a blast, like something substantive and interesting, but like in a really fun way. But I don't think I'd ever do that like in a, you know, like as a career. I think it would just be kind of a one-off thing that'd be fun to do.
Cool. I have one other thing that I want to just ask you quickly, that I have been doing a podcast series with Josh Wigler, where we are going back through time and watching. We watched an episode 1 of Survivor. We watched an episode 2 of the season. We watched an episode 3. And on Monday, we're going to be watching episode 6 of Survivor Cook Islands, an episode called Plan Voodoo, where Cowboy talked to you about a dream that he had, and he basically talked about how he had a vision to be able to untangle how to break a tie with the hidden immunity idol. Can you just quickly do you have any anecdotes or memories from learning about Plan Voodoo and how Cowboy had dreamt that 3 and 3, this is the way that ultimately that the idols could be flushed from the game of Survivor?
Yeah, that's funny. Quick question. Are you going from episode 1, 2 for different seasons?
Different seasons, or all in we're trying to find the best episode 5, best episode 6. Got it. Yes.
Yeah, Cowboy, man. I haven't thought about Cowboy in a long time. His plan was brilliant. I mean, he's the one who basically came up with the idea of like splitting a vote to defeat an immunity idol. Yeah, Kami was a really interesting guy. Like he's just, I don't know. I don't know how to describe him. He is as crazy in real life as he seems on television. Very well-intentioned person. Occasionally came up with, I mean, a lot of what he said was sort of nonsense, but every once in a while, he came up with something really insightful, some like nugget that was like, whoa, like where did that come from? And Plan Voodoo was one of them, right? So most of the time, I think people just started kind of tuning him out. But he mentioned this thing, I was like, oh, that's really smart, you know, and that totally makes sense. Yeah.
And he thought Penner had the idol, and he felt like this was the plan to be able to disarm it.
Yes, exactly. So unfortunately, he didn't know that I had idol.
And
I also knew that he was now going to be dangerous having this information about having a strategy to defeat the idol. So unfortunately, and his main thing was he decided to go after Becky. And so I felt like I had to defend my alliance mate. But yeah, Cowboy, I would say, had a pretty profound impact on the game, because he basically came up with a strategy that everyone's been trying to use since.
He also wanted to take the immunity idol he would bring it to the reward challenges and to tribal council also. Did you have any feelings on that, of whether, or did you not care?
He always wanted to bring the what?
The immunity idol that he brought I watched the episode this morning that I knew I was talking to you, and he was trying to bring the immunity idol to the reward challenge, and Penner was like, I just don't, I feel like that we're trying to show up the other team. He didn't.
Right. I remember
he said, why? I want to bring it.
Yeah, he was kind of superstitious as well. He thought it was like a good luck charm, so he wanted to bring it with him. But I think, you know, I think the rest of us felt like, you know, you're just kind of rubbing it in people's faces. You don't really want to do that, right? Like, being kind of gratuitous.
Okay. All right. Well,
unfortunately, they never, you know, on Cook Islands, there was definitely a one point where they could have, the opposing tribe after Roro, once we merged, could have defeated me. They never employed the strategy, which I never quite understood why. I think it was because they never listened to Penner and gave any credence to the idea that I might have an idol, mm-hmm. but there was something they could have clearly done, a strategy they could have employed to basically wipe out my alliance and then kind of split the vote to flush out the idol and then get rid of me, mm-hmm. which they never did. And if they had listened to either Penner, I guess, could they have listened to Cowboy? Because no one at the time, was anyone from the Arc Tribe? No, I guess they wouldn't have listened to Cowboy. Mm-hmm. So they didn't know about split the vote.
Yeah.
But okay. Yeah, fortunately for me, like, we got rid of Cowboy before that even.
Fortunately for you. And fortunately for us. Yule, thank you so much. I really appreciate you spending so much time with me. I'm so glad that you were up to talk about everything from Survivor 40.
Yeah, I really appreciate it. And again, for everyone else who's out there, I'm sorry I've been kind of out of it. I probably will. I'll try to do like an MA on Reddit. But I probably will. Yeah, I promised to do it. And so I still
plan to do it.
But I probably will stay off social media for a while. Not because I want to.
You're not missing anything, Yule.
Really?
Yeah, it's nothing's fine. It's fine.
Social media
No, you're not missing anything.
Really?
You're fine. You're fine. So, the great Yule Kwan, thank you for spending time with us. Really appreciate it. And all the best to you and your family. And keep up everything you're doing, Yule.
Same to you, Rob. Thanks so much.
Support for this podcast comes from our friends over at Hyundai, makers of the all-new Hyundai Tucson, where they question everything. Learn more at Hyundai.com. And of course, thanks again to our friends over at Geico. Do you own or rent your home? Sure you do, and I bet it can be hard work, but you know what's easy? Bundling your policies with Geico. Geico makes it easy to bundle your homeowners or renter's insurance along with your auto policy, and it's a good thing too, because you already have so much to do around your home. Go to Geico.com, get a quote, see how much you could save. It's Geico easy. Visit Geico.com today. That's Geico.com.